Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to another edition of Outlook, this one being recorded on Wednesday, the 29th of May, 2024. What have we got in this programme? Well, we've got Elaine meandering off into Barford to tell you something, Barton on the Heath, I beg your pardon, telling you something about that. That's next week, isn't it? Barton on the Heath. I've got it all wrong. It's Barford this week. And the... Elaine's sitting there giggling, thinks I'm all completely wrong. I've got it right now. She's in Barford, aren't you, Elaine?
Well, I was.
You was in Barford this week. Good, excellent, thank you. Also, of course, last week Stella started telling you about the first day of the week, Monday. This week she talks about the second day of the week, Tuesdays. And Keith continues and completes the story of Nick Croft, who is David Croft's son, who was the writer and the brains behind the Half-Hot Mum and Warmington-on-Sea, of course. The modern society nowadays makes do and doesn't mend, unfortunately, and Sue looks into why we've got this throwaway society and what maybe can do about it. This time of the year also forget-me-nots are in full bloom, but forget-me-nots aren't only flowers, they can be other things as well, as again Elaine will tell you in her article coming up later in the programme. And finally, Dave goes to the Charterhouse and he goes maypole dancing. But before all that, we've got the report from the centre here. Sport is back, of course, your postbag, but we're going to start, as always, with the news with Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Coventry Building Society has finalised its £780 million deal to buy the Cooperative Bank, but will not be giving its members a vote. The purchase is subject to approval from financial regulators, but is expected to be complete in early 2025. The combined financial institutions will have millions of customers and about $89 billion worth of assets. Both organisations will continue to operate under their current names and branding while they are integrated, which is expected to take several years. Coventry Building Society manages about £50 billion worth of mortgages and $48 million worth of savings. The Co-op Bank has about 2.5 million retail and business customers and 50 branches across the country. The deal means Co-op Bank will return to a mutual structure where it is owned by individual members rather than shareholders and investors like most UK banks. Co-op Bank was part of the wider Co-op Group before splintering off when it fell into deep financial difficulty. It was rescued by American hedge funds and is currently owned by a group of private equity investors. Both brands will stay on the high street during the time it takes to join them together, but said there will inevitably be change over time. Coventry Building Society said it would benefit from having more customers, mortgage and savings balances, a wider set of finance products, including current accounts, and more branches spread across the country. In coming to this decision, the Coventry Building Society Board has been informed by member surveys and focus groups, which clearly signalled their priorities as maintaining our value proposition and service quality, the business said. Coventry Building Society Chief Executive Steve Hughes said the two institutions combined will be able to deliver more value to more people in the coming years. Nick Slape, Co-op Bank's chief executive, said the deal was a natural next step and presents an exciting opportunity.
The general election on the 4th of July will be fought with new constituencies, putting thousands of West Midlands voters in unfamiliar seats. The new boundaries were confirmed last year after a lengthy process by an independent boundary commission in the four UK nations. Overall, the West Midlands region loses two constituencies, taking it from 59 to 57 seats in the new Parliament. Voters in Coventry and Warwickshire will still elect 9 MPs in the snap general election called by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Coventry will still have 3 seats, although changed boundaries have resulted in the renaming of one seat from Coventry North East to simply Coventry East. Warwickshire keeps its 6 seats. Nuneaton, Rugby and North Warwickshire remain, though with Bedworth added to the name of the latter. Leamington, Stratford-on-Avon and Kenilworth and Southam see some council wards moved between them, but are otherwise unchanged. Labour currently has all 3 Coventry MPs, while the Tories hold 5 of the seats in Warwickshire. 2 veteran Tory MPs are standing down, with former Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi and Mark Pawsey vacating their seats. And in Coventry East, formerly Coventry North East, there'll be a new MP, whatever happens, as Labour's Colleen Fletcher is stepping down from the constituency after 9 years. Coventry South, which spans the entire city centre, including the cathedral and the university, which means that there's a significant student vote in the constituency, sees Labour's Sarah Sultana defending a wafer-thin majority of just 401 votes. This is the closest the Tories have ever come to taking the seat, which had been an impenetrable Labour fortress since the mid-20th century. Even closer in 2019, though, was Coventry North West, where just 208 votes separated the top 2 candidates, the smallest majority in Coventry and Warwickshire. Labour's Tairo Owatemi came out on top, replacing the long-time incumbent and former Cabinet Minister Geoffrey Robinson. There are no boundary changes here at this election, so it will be fought on exactly the same terms as in 2019. Kenilworth and Southam constituency was only created in 2010, with Sir Jeremy Wright winning the seat for the Conservatives at every general election since. It's a large and overwhelmingly rural area that's considered to be one of the safest Conservative seats. Boundary changes mean that it has absorbed some villages from neighbouring Warwick and Leamington. Warwick and Leamington has flipped between Labour and Conservative since 1997. Labour's Matt Western has been the incumbent since 2017, but boundary changes mean that voters who were in Tory-leaning Kenilworth and Southam have been brought into the constituency.
A new exhibition will explore how Leamington Spa benefited financially from colonialism and the transatlantic slave economy. It opens at the Leamington Spa Art Gallery and Museum on Saturday and is on display until the 15th of December. The free exhibition looks at the town's links with West Africa, the Caribbean and the Americas from the late 18th to the early 20th century. A spokesperson said, "Like places and people all over Britain, Leamington Spa and its inhabitants benefited hugely from the wealth generated by colonialism and the transatlantic slave economy. This money funded much of Leamington's Grand Regency architecture and flowed down through the generations, supporting wealthy residents through the Victorian period and beyond. The legacies persist in the town today, including in the collections of the Art Gallery and Museum. The exhibition features the history behind local landmarks, including the Royal Pump Rooms and the Regent Hotel, alongside surprising stories like the town's popularity with Confederates during the American Civil War. Objects on display include rarely seen 19th century West African pieces, such as Congolese ivory carvings and a Sierra Leonean balafon, a traditional percussion instrument. Curator Lily Crowther said, "People are talking more and more about the role of the transatlantic slave trade in the development of Britain's big trading cities, like London, Liverpool and Bristol. But the histories of empire and colonialism are intertwined with our local history all over the country. This exhibition shows the variety and complexity of relationships with the Atlantic world, even in an inland resort like Leamington. The exhibition is accompanied by a book, British Local History and the Black Atlantic."
Coventrians vehemently disagree with the city's inclusion in a list of top staycation destinations. One branded it a joke, while another added, "I don't think so." The city featured in a list of places across the UK to enjoy a break if you don't want to travel overseas. Compiled by Consumer Champions Which, it ranked destinations from a survey of around 4,000 people who shared their experiences of visiting UK towns and cities since 2022. The rankings were based on factors including food and drink, cultural sites, accommodation, value for money and tourist attractions. Liverpool came out on top in the large cities category, followed by York, Edinburgh, Glasgow and Belfast. Coventry came in 18th place, just behind Birmingham. Stratford-in-Avon made the top five in the small towns category, followed by St Andrews, Durham and Winchester. Facebook users gave their verdict on Coventry's favourable staycation rating, and it's fair to say that not many agreed. One began, "Are you sure it's Coventry in England that they're on about?" Another added, "Good God, all I can say is they must have stayed in some really bad places if they think that. The city centre looks nicer, but if I lived here, well, perhaps that would be a different story." One Coventrian, though, pointed out plenty of things visitors can enjoy and criticised the naysayers. "Thanks, everyone. I was going to come and spend money supporting local businesses while seeing the old and new cathedrals, the original cathedral site, St Mary's Guild Hall, Charterhouse, Paxton's Arboretum, the Herbert, Cov Music Museum, the Transport Museum, stop at the new fab city centre hotels, take in some of the loads of gigs and theatre happenings, maybe even catch the Sky Blues. But, oh well, I guess from your comments, I'd better give Coventry a miss."
A digital recycling scheme aimed at reducing electronic waste and getting more communities online has received £80,000 of funding. Coventry City Council was given the investment to help expand the Coventry Connects Device Bank, which launched last year. The programme aims to give community organisations and charities digital devices, which can be distributed to residents. About 2,500 devices have been provided to organisations across the city, the local authority said. Created by Hubbub and Virgin Media O2, the Time After Time e-waste fund invests in projects that help to close the digital divide. A total of £500,000 is being shared across the country to help communities in need get online. The City Council said the Coventry Device Bank would receive regular donations from the NHS Integrated Care Board and Coventry and Warwickshire Partnership Trust due to the new funding. Councillor Richard Brown added the project was about making sure none of our residents are digitally excluded. The money will allow us to expand our efforts and get more of these devices into the hands of the most vulnerable. Having your own device, which you can use every day, is something that has the potential to completely transform your life, he said.
A primary school in Coventry, where pupils understand the importance of the school values of curiosity, collaboration, respect, resilience and kindness, where nobody learns without getting it wrong, has received great praise from Ofsted. Children were said to treat everyone with the same level of respect and kindness at Ravensdale Primary School in Wycombe. Inspectors visited the school in March, and their outcome states that Ravensdale Primary School continues to be a good school. Inspectors noticed that there are strong relationships between pupils and staff, and each have high expectations of its pupils who do what they can to be the best versions of themselves. Pupils enjoy a range of opportunities inside and outside the classroom. Throughout the school year, there are various musical events that they take part in. They appreciate the special events and visits to places of interest, while older pupils value the leadership opportunities that they can apply for. The school is continuing to develop pupils' learning so that the most important skills and knowledge are developed over time. This ensures there are appropriate learning plans in place and consistent standards across all subjects. pupils enjoy their reading as widely as possible in and out of school. One Year 6 pupil told the inspectors, "When I'm reading, I just want to know more. I can't stop." Music is a great strength of the school, where all pupils enjoy and look forward to their lessons. There are nearly 100 pupils in the school choir, and older pupils have formed an orchestra and school band, so pupils experience a range of creative and performance opportunities.
Scientists at the University of Warwick say they have been part of an international team to discover a new habitable Earth-sized planet. Working with NASA and the European Space Agency, they say Gliese 12b has the same temperature as we experienced in the 2022 UK heatwave, and is one of the few known rocky planets where humans could theoretically survive. But the planet's distance of 40 light years away means it is too far away to experience more closely, the university said. Warwick astrophysicist Dr. Thomas Wilson said, "This is a really exciting discovery and will help our research into planets similar to Earth across our galaxy. The planet has an estimated surface temperature of about 42 degrees centigrade, but we are unsure of what, if any, its atmosphere is like. Thrillingly, this planet is the closest Earth-sized and temperature planet we know. The light we are seeing now is from 1984, 40 years ago, and that's how long it has taken to reach here on Earth. Planets like Gliese 12b are very few and far between, so for us to be able to examine one this closely and learn about its atmosphere and temperature is very rare. It orbits its version of the Sun every 12.8 days and is a similar size to Earth. The planet's equivalent of the Sun, called Gliese 12, is a cool red dwarf located in the constellation Pisces, and the planet receives 1.6 times more energy from its star than Earth does from the Sun," the university said. Larissa Palethorpe, co-lead of the study and doctoral student at the University of Edinburgh and University College London, said it was a unique candidate for further atmospheric study to help unlock some aspects of our own solar system's evolution. Earth remains habitable, but Venus does not due to its complete loss of water. Gliese 12b's atmosphere could teach us a lot about the habitability pathways planets take as they develop, she added.
Britain's Got Talent's judge Simon Cowell heaped praise on the amazing Coventry cheerleading squad, Lady Grenades. They opened Tuesday, that's yesterday night's live show on ITV, in spectacular fashion. The squad, who are part of Coventry Dynamite, impressed the panel with their high-octane routine to Girls Just Wanna Have Fun, with Bruno Tognoli saying it was the best way to start the show. Mr. Cowell said, "You've worked on that choreography. I can tell the difference. You've changed the structure. You've made those incredible acrobatic synchronizations even better. That was excellent. Exhilarating fun. Excellent." He joked that he was now an expert on cheerleading, and he added, "I do know when an actor's improved from their audition to the semi-final and then this, which for me was a big, big, big step up. The audition for me didn't have quite enough cheerleading in it, a little bit too much dance. But this one was obviously on point. The track was great, you filled the stage, the energy was amazing, and you must have put so much work into it." Alicia Dixon said that their personality was as sparkly as their outfits, adding, "It takes much courage to do what you're doing, and much trust. You make it look seamless, but I know how hard you've worked, and it's paid off tonight. You should be really proud." Presenters Ant and Dec gave a shout out to the parents of the cheerleaders in the audience before Ant, or perhaps Dec, said, "What a start to the show." But despite the praise, the squad did not make it into the live finals. it will be magician Jack Rhodes and Harry Bow, who will be among those battling to be crowned the 2024 winner during the final next Sunday, June the 2nd. However, although Lady Grenades saw their Britain's Got Talent journey end, they've much to celebrate. They recently took part in the Cheerleading World Championships in Orlando in Florida, where they finished first among European teams and third in the whole world.
A huge new 2.5 million dental practice will soon be opening in Coventry. My dentist is set to open later this year at Central 6 Retail Park on Warwick Road. Headquartered in Manchester, My Dentist is the largest dental care provider in the UK. It has existing city practices on Kingston Road in Earlston and Moseley Avenue in Cowden. Both will soon be closing ahead of the brand new site opening at Central 6 Retail Park. Customers can expect state-of-the-art facilities following the huge investment. Bosses said the new city centre-based practice will have a greater range of dental treatments and technology, as well as disabled access and improved travel links, as it is just minutes from Coventry train station. It will be opening this October. Around 24,000 existing patients will be relocating to the new city centre-based My Dentist. All will be given an enhanced choice of treatment options, including teeth straightening, hygiene appointments, dental implants and teeth whitening. John Hudson, property director at My Dentist, said, "We are thrilled to be on track to open our new Coventry practice in October. It marks an exciting chapter for My Dentist, with the new Central 6 Retail Park site being one of the largest practices we will have ever opened." Adrian Leach, Area Development Manager, said, "While we work to ensure the practice is ready to open its doors officially in October, our teams, both My Dentist Earlston and My Dentist Cowden, remain committed to providing patients with the best possible level of care." He added, "We look forward to welcoming patients into the new practice in October and to delivering affordable care to the community of Coventry, so that they can continue to access the vital dental care when they need it."
And now an update to a story we featured earlier this year. A woman who's been collecting books to distribute to schools in Coventry said that she's now collected almost 13,000 since beginning in January. Maeve Walsh, also known as the Reading Doctor, started the book bank to ensure that children could have access to books and to take them home. The educational consultants said she'd been in touch with about 16 schools, but was aware there were plenty more to contact yet. "I'll never say no to books," she said, adding that she planned to continue after being inspired by the children she helped. She said she gathered books from the community and then donated them to city schools, dropping more than 1,000 to Frederick Bird Academy just last Thursday. The school said they welcomed this huge donation of books. "We are so, so grateful. We can't believe the generosity of Maeve. The fact that every child in our school will now be able to go home tonight with a free gift of a book is brilliant." Miss Walsh said, "When I first started, my intention was to have a small library of books of perhaps 100. But on the very first evening I started collecting, the 11th of January, I got about 400 books, and now we're edging towards 13,000 that have been collected all across the city and have then gone straight out to schools again." She said she was very proud, but felt that even now she was still only scratching the surface. "There are so many more schools I haven't spoken to yet that I know would appreciate books like these. I've had parents contact me saying their child came home really excited," she said, adding, "and that was just music to my heart, and it's inspiration for me to just keep going."
A cat has been found after going missing from his home in Coventry 11 years ago. Chloe McCrea was devastated when her cat Bandy disappeared after being let outside in Kersley on bonfire night in 2013. But Bandy had not gone far and was identified at a vet surgery only 13 miles away in Solihull earlier this month. Well, I think that's quite far for a cat. He had adopted a loving new family, and Mrs. McCrea gave her blessing for him to remain with them. Bandy was found by a woman in a Solihull graveyard about 2 weeks after going missing. She was unable to care for him, so gave him to her mother. He lived with the family for more than a decade under his new name, Tigger, and his microchip was not picked up. His former life was only discovered when the family took him to be chipped ahead of new guidance. Mrs. McCrea visited him at a vet's in Solihull after getting the call. "I was in absolute shock and ecstatic," she said. "It was almost as if he was back from the dead, because I had grieved for him. I like to think he remembered me. He did sit on my lap for quite a period of time, but then he is super friendly towards everyone," she added. Despite the emotional reunion, Mrs. McCrea decided to leave Bandy with his new family, because when his new owner found out, she was devastated. She thought she was going to have to lose him, she said. "We only had him for about a year, and she's invested so much in him. We have two children, two dogs, Bandy's brother, and another cat. It probably wouldn't be fair to bring him back," she continued. She swapped numbers with the new owner so they could exchange pictures. To know nothing untoward happened and that someone was looking after him all this time is just the best outcome you could hope for, she said. And we end on that perfectly lovely note.
Outlook News.
Thank you for the news there from Elaine and John. Now, I have a surprising few announcements to make. The inevitable one, of course, about sunrise and sunset, which is 4:52 in the morning and 9:15 in the evening. I've also had a note here from Judith Missenden, who says, "Could you please announce on Outlook tape that the Coventry Macular Support Group have some spaces on their outing to the National Arboretum? The date is Tuesday the 25th of June, meeting at 9:45 in the morning for a 10 a.m. departure at Bond's Hospital Flats in Hill Street, and the return time will be about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The cost is £22, which will include tea and coffee on arrival. And if you're interested, please contact Judith Missenden, and her telephone number is 02476 274 780, or her mobile 07412 650161. And she says, please leave a message and contact name if you don't get a reply from her, and your number, of course, and she'll get back to you. Or, of course, if you're on your computer, you can email her on jmissenden, that's M-I-S-S-E-N-D-E-N, at hotmail.co.uk. So that's a little note from the Macular Support Group. I've also got a little note for Bob. I noticed in Postbag last week he was talking about the formation of CBS. I think, Bob, it was 1975. So we're very close to the old, quite right, very close to 50 years next year.
Wow.
And finally, I have got some dates for bands in the park for this year. The June, well, I'll give you a couple of the June first now. June the 2nd is the WMP Covington Silver Band.
War Memorial Park.
Oh, thank you. I'm being told what WMP means, not being Coventry, and apparently means War Memorial Park. So apologies for that. Now, this one, which is SP, which is Stoke Park, I know that one, the band is to be announced, and that's on the 16th of June. I've got all the dates here, but we'll tell you a couple each time, each week, as we go along. But from that announcement, we're on to Joe, who's here to tell us all about the centre.
Hello.
What's happening?
Thank you, Nigel. Nice to be here again. I haven't spoken to you for some weeks now, so...
I've seen you.
Yeah. Yeah, I meant the people listening on the airwaves,
yes.
So it's nice to be back. Hugh's away for a few days.
Yes,
yes. So I've got a few things to let you know about, things that are going on here at the Resource Centre for the Blind. First of all, I should probably mention that my office has moved. Well, not my office itself, but I've moved from one office into the one next door. So in case anyone is at the centre and wants to know where we are, I've moved into what was Denise's office at the top of the stairs. So I'm still upstairs, And Denise has moved downstairs. She's in what used to be the Boston Lodge office. So she's on the ground floor now. So if you are looking for Denise, she's slightly relocated.
She was there when I first started as a volunteer. She was in that room.
She was, many years ago. That's quite right. She started down there. Yeah, and worked there for some time.
So who's in your old office then now?
Claire is working in my old office, and there's a spare desk in there now. So if we need to move, locate somebody else, there's room to do it. And
good.
The two people. So that's just by the by.
Will you move forward, please?
Sorry, so the other things to tell you about, this evening here at the centre, I think he was probably mentioned, Chris is running a showdown evening for people to come and try playing Showdown, the game for sight impaired and visually not impaired people. It all looks quite exciting.
Have you not tried it yet?
Pardon?
Hugh's tried it. No, have you tried it?
I haven't tried it yet, no.
Why not?
I don't know, just too busy doing other things.
Of course, tonight you're referring to is tonight, Wednesday, when we're recording.
Wednesday, yes, with the point I'm speaking to you, will have been gone by the time you hear this, I expect. But if anyone has missed it and wants to have a go when you're at the centre, just let us know. There'd be a way of going next door and giving it a try. Chris would be happy to show people. And the idea is to get maybe a team going, but certainly to build it in somehow to the programme that we offer. The other thing to let you know, there's a new walking group starting on June the 4th, Tuesdays, between 11 and 1 o'clock. That is intended to be for newcomers, not so much for people that already go on the Wednesday group. We'd like your Wednesday walkers to carry on as is, but we thought there were times when there were too many for one group on a Wednesday. So we will be sort of making a list, really, first come, first served in terms of newcomers. So if you haven't done the walking group yet and you would like to come on a Tuesday between 11 and 1, please let reception know and we will put you on the list. I think we're starting on the 4th of June, so it might start gradually and we'll monitor how it goes. And I think Paul Norman will be influential in running that one for us. There's a theatre trip coming up, the pretty much monthly now, isn't it? The theatre at the Criterion Theatre in Earlsdon. Next one will be on Tuesday, the 24th of June, so it's a Tuesday this time. And the play is by Pinter, The Homecoming. And Hugh is actually acting in that one, so you'll be able to see him doing his thing on stage. The tickets, I believe, are £12.50. And then there's the cost of fish and chips, supper beforehand, and transport to and from if you need it. The maximum number we can get in one bus is going to be 9, so please tell us soon if you do want to come and you need transport. If you want to come with a family member and let us know, we'll get them, you and your partner or friend, whoever it might be, tickets. But just let us know in reception. So Tuesday, 24th of June, The Homecoming. Looking ahead a little bit, just to put the date in everybody's diaries, 13th of July is the date for our summer garden party. I don't know if anyone remembers last summer, but we had the Lord Mayor here, Rosie of course was here, and it poured.
It was the only Saturday that it was wet.
It was terrible, wasn't it?
Yes.
And we had the canopies out and that helped, but it was very, very damp. So this weather is not promising great things at the moment, but maybe by then we'll be all right. So we will have some sort of party, hopefully outdoors. And we've got the Coventry Ukulele Ukaholics, they're called, band coming. So we'd love them to do a couple of numbers in the garden as well. And then looking ahead a little bit further to the end of July, we have a team of 8. We're trying to find one more person for our team for a fundraising event, the Inflatable 5K. Ginormous inflatable obstacles over a 5K course at the Warwick University, all for a bit of a laugh and to try and raise some money.
Suitable for visually impaired?
Yeah, Claire and Chris are both doing it.
Fine, no problem.
Obviously, we would talk to anyone who... You need to be fit enough, I would suggest, to
see the obstacle.
You have to know where they are.
It would help, but fit enough physically to be able to
you
get yourself...
You fall over in them,
You know, these obstacles will be fairly bouncy, you'll be knocked around a little bit.
And they look fairly
You need
big.
To jump on and off
the
them.
Pictures.
Yes.
Yeah, there's nothing too scary, but it's just physically a little bit demanding. Yeah. So Not that I'm very fit these days. I'm going to have a go. And we've got a team of seven so far. We're just looking for one more committed person to help us. And then we look really for all you lovely people to sponsor us or donate in the cause. So if we can all get over the 5K obstacle course without doing ourselves any great harm, that would be a cause for celebration. That's on the 27th of July, so it's a little way ahead, but just letting you know. And then the last thing I'd like to talk to you about, something that we've had an email about from a company called Exafield, exafield.com. There's a lady called Rebecca who has contacted us because they are a medical company doing medical market research, and they are doing a project to investigate the impact of something they're calling geographic atrophy, GA. My understanding of that is it's really the condition of the eyes when you have more advanced macular degeneration. So if you are somebody who's had significant sight loss due to macular degeneration, they would be interested in talking to you, you and a carer, or you on your own with support if you need it. They're looking into the life experiences, really, of what it's like to live with that level of degeneration of sight. I'm not quite sure. It seems as though it's more to do with life quality. It could also be that their research feeds into medical developments, pharmaceutical companies and that sort of thing. It's all done confidentially. It requires you to be able to go online. We can help people with that if needed. And then they have a
sort of Zoom, you see,
it's a sort of online questionnaire set by the look of it. And then after that, there's a telephone follow up.
Right, yeah.
And if you do participate, you receive £65 as a little bit of an incentive, and the charity also receives a £30 donation. Not that that's any pressure, really.
If we've got listeners out there who would like to participate but haven't got a computer, they come in here and do it?
Yes, we could certainly facilitate it.
Okay.
I can't tell you an awful lot more about what it involves, but it's obviously more a detailed sort of level of interaction to find out about your experiences of living with that condition. So let us know here at the Centre if you feel interested in helping them out. And I think that's probably all I need to say.
The 8-hour silence challenge, isn't there, coming up as well?
Yes.
17th
yes.
July.
Yes. 13th of July, is it? 17th? No, you might be right, 17th. Yes. I haven't got it written down in front of me.
You want people to answer for that, don't you?
Joe, who most people know is not the quietest individual on the planet, politely explained, but Joe works in our charity shop here at Earlsdon and does support for the craft group and various other things. And she has volunteered very gamely, I would say, to do an 8-hour sponsored silence. We're all agog to see how that works.
Apparently the first one lasted 25 minutes.
Is that right?
According to you, yes.
Well, you might be right.
She said hello for Robin.
Yeah, we're going to have to set out some parameters, I think, so that we can
it should be quite a
keep an eye on her. But I think it'll be quite fun. Obviously, it's just a bit fun, but it's also to raise some money. So thank you, Joe. And if you'd like to join in some way and donate, maybe we can get you to donate for every 10 minutes of silence she manages or something like that.
Shouldn't be too expensive, apparently, according to the answer.
Yeah, we might have to chunk it into time chunks, mightn't we, just in case. So there's a few things coming up. So ask about that reception and we'll tell you a bit more as we get nearer the time.
Good. Thank you
all very much.
Thank you. I guess you'll be back next week, will you?
Yes, you will. Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Sarah was away for a handoff, as you may remember, last week, but I'm pleased to say, although well bandaged up for a while, she's back with us again this week.
Well, hello there, lovely listeners, and it is so fantastic to be back. Though big thanks to Elaine for that excellent article last week on the origins of the Olympics. Now that gives me a great chance to talk about the Olympics. Well, not actually in the Olympics per se, but I'll start with rugby union because at the weekend, Coventry's Cove Rugby Club's 150th anniversary season drew to a conclusion with a match against England. Well, England under 20s anyway, but I'm pleased to report that Coventry finished in triumph, 54 points to 34. So well done there, Cov. You did us proud. And here's to another 150 years, though me mum never forgave you for moving from Camden Road. But anyway, that's another issue. But going back to the Olympics, rugby is sort of in the Olympics, but it's the rugby sevens, which is a quicker game than union. It's more akin to league, but even quicker than that. And like union, there are no such things as scrums, and a lot of the sort of rough and tumble element is taken out. And it's a much faster game because there are only 7 players per team. Anyway, one sport definitely in the Olympics is athletics. And Josh Kerr, my gosh, he must be hoping like mad and pretty damn certain of making the British team. For a final long last, he's beaten Steve Cram's 39-year-old British record for running the mile. And the great thing was that Steve Cram was commentating on it when Josh broke it. Anyway, he ran a mile in 3 minutes, 45 seconds and 3.34. Gosh, do you remember when Sir Roger Bannister, as he then became, was hailed as a hero for breaking the 4-minute mile? They're now running 15 seconds quicker. This, if you're interested, was in Oregon, and he beat Jakob Ingebrigtsen. In fact, Ingebrigtsen was probably responsible for him getting the record, because he pushed him to the line. Not literally, I hasten to add, because that would be cheating. But you know what I mean. I'm going to be talking quite a lot between now and the Olympics about tennis, because we are well and truly into the tennis summer season, shall we say. We currently have the French Open. Then we'll go into the round in Britain of Queens, Eastbourne, etc., Birmingham, Wimbledon. And then the Olympics. But the Olympic selection I'll talk about first isn't actually like, for instance, athletics and swimming, where each country has 3 places and they get to select which 3, as long as they're over a certain standard, get to go. Oh, no. Now, there are 5 events in the Olympics, as there are in all majors. Men's, singles and doubles, women's singles and doubles, and the mixed doubles. But instead of sort of selection by country, it's the top 56 in the ranking points after the French Open get the opportunity to go. They obviously, some of them decide, apparently, to turn it down in favour of some of the paid tournaments, which of course have ranking points. But gosh, who turned down the opportunity to go to the Olympics? Anyway, as things stand at the moment, only Great Britain has 3 players who look as if they should be selected, namely Cameron Norrie, Jack Draper and Katie Bolter. Well, Katie, you ain't going to be playing in the women's doubles, but you might make a mixed doubles if one of the guys will team up with you. That, to me, seems a bit, I won't use the word unfair, but disappointing, perhaps, is a good word, because it does mean that where there's a specific excellence, such as, for example, Jamie Murray in the doubles, he won't be able to go. Anyway, that is that, so that's what we have to go with. Now back to the French Open. It's played on clay, which apparently, according to my speaky speaker, A-L-E-X-A, but she's listening, is a much slower surface than the others, but being hard court and grass, but the balls bounce much higher. And that is the one that will be used in the Olympics. In fact, the same venue as the French Open, with it being Roland Garros. But, oh dear. At the time of me recording this, two Brits have played and two Brits have lost in straight sets in the opening round. Mm-hmm. The first one, the aforementioned Jack Draper, who only managed to get in half of his first serves. And Andy Murray, who did take part in the Battle of the Veterans. He was on court with Stan Wawrinka of Switzerland, and they had a combined age of 76, with Stan coming in at 2 years the senior to Murray at 39. But anyway, age is no barrier. And he won in straight sets, as I say, 3-love. Now, I'm sorry that sport's been a little bit shorter this week, but there isn't actually that much sport going on at the moment, other than the major tournaments, which you will have heard covered, if you're interested, on the sports programmes anyway. Whereas I try to bring a bit of variety and a bit of humour. But, and finally, one sport not in the Olympics, thank heavens, is darts. Or perhaps I should say, not in the Olympics yet. Anyway, you may have heard of Luke Lidler, the 19-year-old British sensation who won his first major championship at the weekend. Now, I was listening to BBC Sport, and one of the commentators was talking and eulogising about Luke's fantastic attitude and what a nice personality he is and how great his manners are. But he then rather shot himself by saying, "Oh yes, he's a young man with his feet firmly on the table." Well, I'm sorry, but having your feet firmly on a table was not a sign of manners when I was a young kid. But anyway, we know what he meant. And that, this week, has been your sport. Just like me, short and sweet. Well, short anyway. Bye!
Well, there you are, the things commentators say. So, what's in your postbag this week? Let's find out from Dave.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. Graham Whale starts it off by trying to help Sarah Lewis, who's got problems filling in a postal voting slip due to her visual impairment, and wants to know about what help you can get in the polling stations if you're visually impaired. First, he talks about the lack of toilets in the city centre.
Before I respond to Sarah Lewis, just a short addenda to my piece on public toilets in Coventry. Because I've been thinking, if the council think we perhaps ought to go into shops when we want to go to the toilet in the city centre, there is actually a toilet in the council house. So maybe if everybody aimed for the council house toilet when they need to go, it might concentrate the council's mind a little. Anyway, that aside, I feel I ought to know the answer to Sarah's problem about voting in elections, but I don't. It's been extended quite extended coverage on in Dutch on Radio 4, and they have improved it over the years, but it looks to me like it's a bit patchy in different local authorities areas, and I've no idea what it's like in Coventry. Maybe Sarah needs to do a bit of work before she really decides to give up her postal vote. I do have a postal vote, and my reader, which is supplied by the Coventry Reader Service for the Blind and Partially Sighted, fills it in for me on my instructions, and he is 100% reliable. There's no question about that. He's 100% reliable. And, well, it beats going out on a cold and wet winter day to vote.
Thank you, Graham. I'm afraid the general election has turned out to be sooner rather than later. It's on June the 4th. I had a phone message from Outlook presenter Elaine. She has kindly put me on to a presiding officer called Linda, who remembers you from Earlston School, Sarah, when you were prefects together. She was Linda Cantis then. She says, I can give you her phone number so you can get in touch. Elaine says that in Coventry, the polling stations will be well stocked with equipment to help visually impaired people. There were torches to give extra light in the booth. There were large ballot papers, magnifying glasses, braille ballot papers. You can take a companion in the booth with you to help you. You can ask the presiding officer. They are perfectly happy to help you. If you can, go to vote in the morning when it's quiet, or if not, early afternoon. But avoid tea time when it gets crowded in there. You will need to take photo identification with you in to vote. You can get an audio recording of the candidates by ringing the elections officers. Sorry, I don't know the phone number right now. If you decide to use the postal vote, get somebody to help you. You will need your national insurance number or some other proof of identification, a photograph and a copy of his signature. With all things you're supposed to have at hand these days, it's a wonder we can find anything. Here's Edwina with a reminder about how to find your Visa card.
Hi everybody. Are you one of those lucky people that has booked for a holiday already? And you want to be on top of everything, clever with your purse? I don't just mean not spending too much. I mean using your Visa card. What I've found is a good tip is to put a rubber band round your Visa card in your purse. And that way you find your paying card straight away. That's among point cards. There's no problem paying them. You just get that card straight away and back into the purse. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. That's really helpful when you're fumbling in your wallet or purse for your Visa card. And just after the general election is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We had some really polished performers at the Monday Club recently. Emily of the D-Day Darlings, along with her musical parents, Elizabeth and Peter. This is Julia's report. Mother and daughter at the Monday Club. I think they were called B-Day Darling, but I might have misheard. That's the trouble with being a bit mutton, Jeff. You don't always hear right. Anyway, I think they were on their 800th anniversary tour, but I may have misheard that too. Everybody in the Monday Club thought they were very good, though, and they raised the roof of the Mary Beale room. My friend John said he would pay for a new roof. Poor old Peggy had a fall and damaged her new hip. Get well soon, Peggy. We all miss you. Hilda was there, though, and she was 103 years old. I didn't mishear that. Anyway, we all had a party and got drunk and got arrested, so it was a good session altogether. Next week I'm going to Malta with my sisters, a place called Meliha. I don't know what it's like. My friend John keeps asking me, but I told him he should stop nagging me. I haven't been there yet. I'll tell everybody all about it when I come home. I missed my Jen. I have to do my own washing up now until I can find Jen Mark II. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Stay safe, Julia. Thank you, Julian. Have a lovely holiday, and I hope you have had a lovely holiday. Hilda, 103, by the time you hear this. Finally, Graham Whale remembers the cottage pub that was sadly in flames.
Yes, I have fond memories of the Cottage Inn in Thurlongley, which had gone up in smoke recently. I've never been inside it, but I can remember sitting outside in a car park in the 50s and 60s. There was a local celebrity who used to use it, Reg Dixon or Reginald Dixon. I always get him mixed up with the organist. He was a musical comedian. His signature tune was Confidentially. And he ran a farm up Corley. And that was his local pub. And he used to turn up at a Sunday lunchtime in his Ford Zephyr. But he started with in tumble dryer, apparently. And I'm coming to the conclusion, tumble dryers are a dangerous thing to have around. They're always setting on fire.
Thank you, Graham. If you have a tumble dryer, the best advice is don't leave it running when you go out or when you're asleep. Be around. And now we have a surprise message to new member of the Monday Club, Elizabeth, from your daughter, Elise. Right, here's Elise.
Hello, Mum. Hope you enjoyed your walk. Me and Jasper came looking for you, but you weren't there, so we'll see you soon. Love you.
I met Elise in the War Memorial Park when myself and members of the Resource Centre's walking group were taking part in the Move for Fun. Chris and Claire say it's not too late to drop some sponsor money into the Resource Centre. Here's Chris.
Hello, this is a message by Chris from Claire, actually, because Claire's busy. Just to say, we're all at the Move for Fun, having lots of fun, although not moving much yet, have we? But when we do, we're doing it, as usual, sponsoring the Resource Centre. So if anybody wants to sponsor us to Move for Fun, the more money you give us, the more laps we'll do, and the more likely we are all to fall in a big, sticky, sweaty mess at the end of this beautifully hot day in the Memorial Park.
Thank you, Chris, and for your messages this week. Thank you for your lovely handmade birthday card for me from Tina. Thank you so much. It's very kind of you to remember my birthday. Now, you can leave a message on our postbag answer phone by ringing 024-76-717-522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. Send a letter written by you or someone on your behalf. Send me an email if you like at davidmonks@hotmail.com or in any way you feel happiest. If you send text messages, you should get this. Have you heard that the man who invented predictive text has died? His funfair is on Monkey. Get it? Thank you for your messages this week. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
So that's your messages this week in Dave's Postbag. Elaine is continuing her meander through the Warwickshire villages, and this week she's ended up in Barford.
The River Avon meanders through Barford on its way to Wasperton, Charlcote and Stratford-upon-Avon. It is a lively village of undulating fields, cut in half by the noisy A429, with numerous little lanes where new houses stand beside old cottages. Barford fathered Joseph Arch, who started the National Union of Agricultural Workers in 1872, went to Parliament as a Liberal MP, and who was born and died in the little cottage opposite the church. Every year, agricultural workers made a pilgrimage to his grave in the churchyard, and one of the public houses bears his name. Many inhabitants enjoy a stroll down Church Street or along the Wellesbourne Road to do their shopping at the thriving stores come post office, where they can meet acquaintances and have a gossip. The old bakery is now a hairdresser's, and the blacksmith now, alas, practices his art from one of the nearby industrial estates, and his forge has been converted into a house. But he and his forebears have left their mark on St. Peter's Church in the form of the weather vane and wrought iron gates. The mill, manufacturing animal feed, goes back many years, and huge lorries turn into and out of Mill Lane several times each day. St. Peter's Church has a rector, who is responsible also for the parish of Wasperton, a little hamlet a mile along the Wellesbourne Road, and for Sherborne, across the river. Sherborne is more than a hamlet, with a magnificent church, built in the 1860s by a member of the Ryland family. The full peal of bells can be heard joyfully echoing across water meadows on Friday evenings, when ringing practice takes place, and again before service on Sunday mornings. St. Peter's Barford is proud of the fact that it has, several times, been awarded the coveted prize for best kept churchyard in the diocese, and bears witness to many hours of hard work. The village in a similar competition has won the best kept village award twice. On the outskirts of the village lies Westham House, an elegant building used during the last war as a girls' school, and now as an adult education college. The mellow red brick reflects the sun, and the well-kept gardens are an ideal working place for the many aspiring artists who assemble for painting courses during the summer months. This is very much tourist country, with Shakespeare and his links a mere 7 miles away. Although not a beautiful village in one sense of the word, all the gardens are bright with flowers and well-tended lawns, and the village green, recreation ground and village hall are all neat and tidy. The hall is the memorial to the Lord Lieutenant's father, who was killed during the war.
Next week, Elaine's off to Botton on the Heath. You may remember last week that Stella recounted some tales about Mondays, so this week she's moved on with some stories about Tuesdays.
Tuesday, the second day of the week, is named after Tu, that's T-I-U or T-I-W, or sometimes Tyre, T-Y-R. However you spell or pronounce him, he was the Scandinavian god of war. Unlucky enough to have had his hand bitten off by the wolf Fenrir when he was trying to chain that animal up. Fenrir was the son of Loki, god of strife and the spirit of evil, and when he gaped, one jaw touched earth and the other heaven. So Tu was maybe pretty lucky to be just losing a hand, and with his daring feat deserved to have a day named after him. Tu is the Scandinavian equivalent of the Roman god Mars, and the French named their day Mardi after him. The Italians also Marti. Talking of spelling, Christopher Robin and his bear Winnie the Pooh were filled with admiration for their friend Owl, because he could spell Tuesday. He didn't spell it right, you understand, but he could spell it so that you knew it wasn't Wednesday. Having spent all Monday washing, the perfect housewife's prospect for Tuesday was ironing. And the lover who beheld his darling, neat and charming in every high degree, found his heart stolen away as she dashed away with the smoothing iron. Well, I was never into ironing myself, but I do have friends who actually look forward to the chore and regard it as a special treat. My motto has always been, life's too short to iron knickers and tea towels, and these days I don't go in for marathon sessions unless packing for a holiday, preferring to tattle only creased outer garments when I'm about to wear them, whatever day of the week it happens to be. Many modern clothes are crease-resistant, of course, or as in the case of the latest dress I've bought, meant to be crinkly and needing to be wrung into shape after washing. And how light and streamlined our irons have become. What a nightmare it must have been in past centuries when people travelled, if you were a servant, that is, ironing all those starched collars, frills and voluminous skirts and petticoats, with enormously heavy flat irons, which had first to be heated in front of the fire. As a child, I can just remember my dad's mother standing an old iron in the flame on her gas cooker. But even then, the rest of the family considered it a dangerous and cumbersome relic of the past. We all know the most famous Tuesday in the calendar, Pancake Day, or Shrove Tuesday, is the day before the season of Lent begins, when people, having made confession and been forgiven or shrived by a priest, made merry before the fast leading up to Easter. In many countries there are festivals at this time, known as Mardi Gras, the French for Fat Tuesday, fat from feasting, stocking up for the slim time ahead. But have you heard of Hock Tuesday? This was celebrated in the week following Easter, up until the 16th century. On Hock Monday, the women of the village seized and tied up the men, demanding a small payment for their release. On Hock Tuesday, the tables were turned, and the men waylaid the women. The money raised was given to the church to be used for work in the parish. Later, the custom changed, and on both days of Hocktide, men and women alternately, with great merriment, intercepted travellers by laying ropes across the road and exacted money from them for charitable causes. The word hock, meaning to pull, derives from this old custom of demanding ransom for those caught and held. We're used to women being named after months, like April, May and June. But who thought up the handle Tuesday Weld? Do you remember this American actress who appeared in films with famous stars like Gregory Peck, Elvis Presley and Anthony Perkins? According to critics, she gave some fine performances but never got taken seriously because of her old name. If she had stayed Susan Weld, says one biographer, she might now be known as one of our great actresses. She was also once known as Mrs. Dudley Moore, that diminutive comedian and musician. But there was nothing unusual there, as over the years he did go in for serial marriage to several tall, blonde ex-models like her. Then there was Ruby Tuesday, who had a pop song written about her by the Rolling Stones. The character was rumoured to be based on a fan who followed the group around, to their Tuesday gigs perhaps, and she does rhyme very well with New Day. I knew a three-year-old who adored this track and always sang it along with Mick Jagger. Then we realised she thought it was about her favourite bear, Rupert Today. Perhaps Miss Weld and Ruby were born on a Tuesday and thus full of grace. And just to keep you up to date on the other rhymes, those that marry on Tuesday marry for health. Those that cut their nails cut them for wealth. And those who sneeze will kiss a stranger. So it can't be bad, whatever you do.
Nick Croft's father was the genius behind those wonderful sitcoms about Dad's Army at Warmington-on-Sea. And this story was started by Keith last week, which he now completes, explaining why that was a mixed blessing for Nick.
Keen as he is to establish himself, Nick doesn't try to obscure the fact that his father's celebrity can open a few doors. It makes me more interesting than another 70-year-old bloke who's just made his debut album. It does allow me to get my foot in. How does he explain the continuing popularity of Dad's Army? Well, it's familiar and it's comforting, and it never contained any offensive language or difficult attitudes. People were allowed to watch it as children with their mums and dads. It was the very definition of family entertainment. Some of the others, It Ain't Half Hot Mum, for instance, or Hello, Hello, would seem racist and sexist by turn these days, but you've got to roll with the times. What was acceptable back then wouldn't be today. The world has moved on. But you don't just ignore the Second World War because people got shot. And the humour was different. My father used to describe his shows as incidentally funny, a comedy emerging from the situation. And he maintained that the basis of good comedy is in truth. What you see in Dad's Army had happened. Yes, it might be slightly exaggerated, but not much. People who'd been in the Home Guard sent in their stories about putting potatoes in the exhaust of German tanks and so on. Jimmy Perry, Croft's frequent co-writer, along with Jeremy Lloyd, was a redcoat at Butlin's, which informed Heidi High. And my dad did all sorts of things to help the holiday camp shows, so they knew what they were writing about. Dad's Army was something of a sleeper hit when it debuted in 1968, and Nick was still a teenager. As viewing figures soared, and it became one of the BBC's biggest hits ever, he got to know the cast, with mixed results. Arthur Lowe wasn't much interested in me. He was a somewhat pompous fellow, full of his own importance. As a result, he did an incredible job of portraying the somewhat pompous Captain Mannering. John LeMessurier, gentle, self-effacing Sergeant Wilson in the sitcom, was a completely different kettle of fish. He and I both shared an interest in jazz. He was a great friend of the pianist Bill Evans and could be found in his spare time at Ronnie Scott's club, sitting chain-smoking in the corner. Wilson's nephew, Private Pike, possibly his son, although that was always implied rather than stated, was played by Ian Lavender, the last of the main cast to pass. He was almost the same age as me, and we got on well. We'd talk about cricket, recalls Nick. Lavender succumbed to terminal cancer, aged 77, at the beginning of February. He'd been ill for some time. His wife is a good friend of one of my sisters, Penny. I'm a committed Christian, so I know you can either fear death or trust in the Lord. On a lighter note, and please let this be true, did Nick really squire Wendy Richard, the delicious Miss Brahms from Are You Being Served, to his 18th birthday party? I did. She was very pretty, very kind, not at all a diva, but sadly already spoken for. My dad arranged it. How about fellow cast member John Inman? Could he be a bit of a diva? The very reverse. He was an absolute sweetie with a wonderful, very English sense of humour, a good friend. When it came to Heidi High, Nick's strongest relationship was with Simon Cadell, for the very good reason that he married his sister, Becky. And as for Sue Pollard, ditzy chambermaid Peggy, certifiably bonkers, surely. Yes, and I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying so. She's very happy to be cast in that type of role. As to what goes on inside her head, I have absolutely no clue, but she's great company, if a little tiring. Ruth Maddock, by contrast, brought a lot of subtlety to her role as Gladys Pugh. I had a secret crush on her. All my sisters are blonde and she was dark, a very sexy woman. As for Paul Shane, camp host at Maplin's, he was born to play Ted Bovis. What you saw was what you got, joke after joke after joke. He had a heart of gold. His wife was severely disabled and he looked after her for many years with uncomplaining devotion. That was then, this is now. What next for Nick? I'd love to make another album. I had such a good time doing the first one, I took It took a lot of arranging, but it came together beautifully, and there's no shortage of material. I must have 60 unrecorded songs. This ongoing project has given him a new lease of life. It means I'm no longer a complete and utter pensioner. It's given me the something to get out of bed for. I can indulge myself at the same time as squandering my children's inheritance. I hope Dad would have been proud.
The television repeats, and some on Radio 4 Extra, of course, of those Home Guard wartime exploits still give me a chuckle. Wartime, of course, was a time of shortages, when everyone had to make do amend. How things have changed, with a throwaway attitude for clothes now so very common. Sue reads an article by Patrick Grant, who claims this attitude, though, is not beyond repair.
Fixing things used to be normal. A routine part of early man's working life was the ongoing repair of the tools they used and the clothes they wore. Every successful human had the basic skills needed to keep his or her possessions in good working order. Throughout most of human history, we have valued our possessions and taken care to keep them for as long as we possibly could. I was born in 1972, and throughout my childhood, I remember all sorts of things, from shoes and jumpers to washing machines, radios and TVs, being regularly fixed. There were TV repair shops on most high streets. Cobblers and tailors were still relatively commonplace. The everyday things we owned and used were made, well, from good quality materials. Most were made in a way which made them repairable. And because we valued things, and they were a bit more expensive, it made economic sense to repair them too. But over the past 50 years, driven by the desire of business to see us buy more and more stuff, the quality and price of the things we bought and used every day began to fall. Things that once lasted decades now lasted just a few years, or less. The design of objects changed, making them more difficult to repair. And as fewer people repaired things, so brands felt they could get away with not supplying spare parts. As the cost of most everyday things has fallen so far, and because repairs by and large have to be done locally by skilled people earning a UK wage, it no longer makes economic sense to repair items. It is easier and cheaper simply to throw them away and buy a new one. As a consumer society, we have changed a great deal since I was born. We own 5 times as many pieces of clothing today than we did, but wear less than a third of it. We have so much stuff, we don't know what to do with it. But has all of this stuff made us happier? I think the answer for a good many people is no. When we had fewer things, we cared about them more. We felt a greater connection to them. When they were made locally, many of us felt pride in their manufacture. And the well-made objects we once used every day, made from natural materials such as wool, leather, wood or stone, got better with age. Through use, they developed character and patina, became more pleasant to look at, to use or wear. When we repaired them, each new repair told the story of the life the object had had and spoke of the care we had shown it over time. We're finally waking up to the idea that this linear model of buy, wear, dump, repeat is no good for anyone. And we are rediscovering the joy of living with fewer but better things. My tailored clothes have had the odd repair, but they're pretty well made, so on the whole, need little. I've had a coat relined. Most of my shoes have been repaired at least once, in some cases several times, mostly just a new sole, but occasionally a full rebuild. I have shoes in my wardrobe that I regularly wear, that I bought more than 30 years ago. Trickers, John Lobb, Churches, Red Wing all go back to the factory for a bit of TLC and come back better than new. I repair my own slippers with needle and thread and sometimes a little webbing tape. I reproof my raincoats either with traditional wax or with Nick wax in the washing machine. Every fix feels like a good deed. Other countries are doing more to encourage this way of living. The French government now gives people money towards the cost of repairs. The EU has made it law that any new white goods have to be repairable, and suppliers are required to provide all necessary spare parts. In Sweden, they have removed the VAT from repairs. In Japan, repaired objects are highly coveted. Torn and worn clothing and textiles are reworked and repaired using darning or patching techniques, making it into what they call boro, which is highly prized. They also practice kintsugi, or golden joinery, where broken pottery is visibly mended using gold. As a culture, the Japanese celebrate rather than hide repair because it speaks of care and its execution requires great skill. But green shoots of change are beginning to appear here in the UK too. Repair shops and repair cafes are springing up across the country. It has become cool to remake and recycle. Darning is on the rise too, both discreet and highly visible, with art darners making great features of their work. I have darned my favourite jumper many times, elbows first, covered with suede patches. Then, when new elbow holes appeared, the new holes were darned and the patches moved to cover both repairs. I've darned thick cashmere socks, much too good to throw away. It's meditative to do. Our new king proudly wears patched clothes and hand-me-downs, and many of us are again discovering that we like to fix things, that repairing something simply makes us feel good.
Let's hope that that wasting world resources with a throwaway attitude can be reversed. One of the flowers that very successfully propagates itself and blooms at this time of the year is the forget-me-not, but that's not the only cognition of the name, as this article written by Keith Garner explains in the summer edition of This England magazine, read by Elaine.
I can't say the words, "My, my, at Waterloo, Napoleon did surrender," without singing them. And I am not alone. Half a century ago, an unknown group from Sweden, dressed in shiny synthetic clothes, silver platform boots, and glittery makeup, took to the stage at the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest in Brighton. As they sang those opening lines, the phenomenon that became ABBA was unleashed to the world, launching them into international stardom. Not bad for a contest sometimes described as bland. Eurovision 1974 was to prove particularly interesting due to a number of events. Having hosted the previous year, Luxembourg declined to do so again due to the financial burden hosting twice consecutively created. Instead, the UK picked up the baton. Katie Boyle presented her fourth Eurovision, dressed in a salmon dress with an ostrich feather collar. Katie remained poised throughout, despite the rumours that 2 minutes prior to filming, her undergarments were removed, as they were visible through the tight satin material. Careful placement of her cue cards and standing behind a podium helped to maintain her modesty. Some 17 countries participated that evening, France withdrawing the week of the competition, following the death of President Georges Pompidou. As his memorial service was to be held the same day, it was deemed inappropriate for them to attend. The British entry, Long Live Love, was performed by Olivia Newton-John, initially unhappy with the song choice and preferring a ballad to this upbeat number. It was chosen by public postal vote and ultimately finished in joint fourth place. The voting system in 1974 involved every country having 10 jury members, each allocated 1 point to vote for their favourite song. The voting order was arranged by drawing lots. David Vine provided the commentary, making an uncharacteristic mistake, mixing up Bjorn and Benny when introducing the ABBA lineup during their promotional video clip. ABBA had attempted to enter the contest the previous year in their country's selection competition, coming third with their entry Ring Ring, that went on to become a huge hit. A masterstroke was changing the original Swedish lyrics to English, broadening their appeal and thus improving their chances of winning, alongside the unexpected entry of their conductor, Sven Olaf Waldorf, arriving on stage dressed as Napoleon. This caused a minor sensation and many raised eyebrows, fitting for the song but unusual for a traditional and formal contest. Amazingly, the UK gave nil points to the Swedish entry and chose to showcase the Wombles as an interval act. Unusually, transmission of the contest to Italy and the playing of their song prior to the contest was deferred for several weeks due to the 1974 Italian referendum on divorce to be held in May of that year. Their entry, entitled Yes, mentioned this word at least 16 times throughout the song and was deemed a form of propaganda, potentially sending a message to the viewing public that might influence the referendum vote. Even more surprisingly, the Portuguese entry, which was to end in last place, was played on an independent radio station on April the 24th, as one of two secret signals alerting rebel soldiers to begin the Carnation Revolution that would ultimately overthrow the government of the time. All in all, 1974 was an unforgettable year in the Eurovision calendar. But those who watched it will ultimately remember the four bright young people that would secure the Eurovision crown for Sweden for the first time, and who would go on to remain one of the most beloved pop acts of all time, even 50 years later. The Eurovision Song Contest final this year will be on May the 11th.
The beginning of this month of May was traditionally a time to welcome the arrival of summer, celebrated with maypole dancing, and that's a tradition still continuing, as Dave found out when he went to the Charterhouse earlier this month.
Hello, big welcome to the Charterhouse. I'm sitting outside the cafe, and it's a lovely day. I'm speaking to Judy. So what do you think of the Charterhouse and the grounds?
It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. There's nothing better than sitting here, looking at the wonderful sight of the trees, the sky, the clouds. It's wonderful warm. There's beautiful flowers, beautiful trees. And the food and the coffee is absolutely fantastic, and the staff are wonderful. I love it. It's such a relaxing place. No matter what stresses you've got, when you get here, you chill out.
That's it. It's such a fascinating place full of history. Thank you so much, June. Hello. We're sitting outside the Charterhouse speaking to Anne. So where are you from?
Well, I'm from, Merseyside originally, and my concertina is all over. So I'm going to play a bit of a tune that listeners might recognise. Cheers. British Grenadiers. Lovely, and we're doing lots of English music today.
And we're going to do some maypole dancing.
We are. We are using some of the old English tunes.
Wonderful, and I'm hoping to take part. Is that okay?
Of course it's okay. It's very satisfying for anybody that takes part in maypole. Sometimes it's seen as a children's activity, but actually there's something about dancing in a circle and weaving the ribbons in and out, which is very satisfying.
It is nice. Is it lost in the mist of time?
No, I think it's fairly well documented that the ribbon sorts that we're using, lovely silky feeling ribbons, the dancing with ribbons goes back to about Victorian times, and of course we're in Charterhouse, which was lived in Victorian times.
Yes.
But the original festivals of May, they weren't with ribbons. People just used to bring a tree or a branch from the forest on around the 1st of May, or when it felt as though winter had gone and summer was on the way, so it might have been June or April.
Yes.
And they'd dance around the tree, and that goes back certainly to the Middle Ages. We don't know before then. As you say, it's lost in the mist of time.
Yes. Okay, so do you belong to a folk dancing group?
I do, as it happens, but I'm here because I run a music business and we take the music to care homes and day centres and all sorts of places and schools.
Well, that sounds lovely. Thank you, Anne. I look forward to maypole dancing.
That's cool. Thank Shall you. We do one more bit of tune?
Yes, okay.
Okay. And this has got words to it. Awakey, pretty maids, awake, rise up from drowsy dream, and to the dairy haste and take for us a dish of cream, if not a dish of yellow cream. Give us kisses free. The woodland bower is white with flower, and green is every tree.
That was lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're walking round in a circle, holding the ribbons. I'm holding green and purple. Yes, it's lovely. Oh, sorry, I have to keep the ribbons straight. Here we are. And there's some young children joining us. And the mum and dad. All right, and the ribbons, as we go round clockwise, the ribbons are being wrapped around the maypole. Well, it's a beautiful pattern that it's forming around the maypole of all the different coloured ribbons. I'm trying to skip along dancing. That was lovely, thank you. The maypole looks beautiful with all the different colours of ribbons wrapped around it. No, I'm speaking to Anne again. Can you tell me about lallygags that people are making, please?
Well, lallygag can mean to stravage around and just to waste time. But a chap called Cyril Papworth, who was a folk researcher in Cambridgeshire, was an agricultural labourer himself in the 1920s. And he said, well, we use lallygags as bits of rope or twine to tie round our trousers so that when we were threshing the corn and the rats were scurrying around, the rats weren't able to run up our trouser legs. That's what his regional origin was. Now, he reckons, and he's not the only one, that the Cotswold Morris dancers who wear bell pads around their knees in that same place, part of the anatomy, just below the knee, they are using that same notion of rope or twine around your trousers, and you tie the bells on there.
Excellent.
So, yes, I don't think the word lallygag is used very much. We're using it today for the children to make very simple lallygags with ribbons.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's been fascinating, been really enjoyable. Maypole dancing, thank you very much.
And I hope some of your customers and some of your listeners will come to Charterhouse.
Yes.
Because even if you can't see exactly the detail, you can hear the echoes, you can feel the stone and the wood in the wonderful old rooms here.
And the volunteers describe everything so beautifully.
There you go.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. The Charterhouse on the London Road, Coventry, is a real Coventry treasure, overlooked for so many years. It's finally been open to the public, for the public to look around and enjoy. It's got beautiful paintings, not seen anywhere else. But you've got guides there on every floor who will describe things beautifully to you. So just come along sometime. Okay. Now I'm speaking to Jane, and they have some beautiful old wall paintings here. If some of our listeners were to come round here, you know, the volunteers would describe them to them.
Yes, that's
beautifully,
yes.
I'm sure.
Yes, that's right. Although we're only doing limited opening hours at the moment,
yes.
So it's best to check first before
yes.
coming.
Thanks a lot, and that's all from the Charterhouse on the London Road and Customs of Merry England. Bye for now.
And Maypole Dancing heralds the end of another edition of Outlook. So from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the Outlook team here, it's goodbye for another week.